Hello, my name is Christopher Holmes, and I'm back again for another zero-point presentation. I would like to thank Don and Doug for their efforts through this blog in service and for setting up a web page for me on the archives, and some archive material is available on the net. And I'm presenting very original teaching, zero-point teaching, and have received a lot of encouragement from Don and Doug. So I would like to thank them, and now I've moved to a two-hour format. And the aim today was to have a guest on for the first hour, but there's some temporary delay in that. So we will have a guest, James Moffat, who will be joining us hopefully within the first hour, although it may be in the second hour. During the show, if you want to email me, you can email me at Christopher Holmes, all small case, at rogers.com. And any comments or questions you'd like to share, I'll then share them on air. I won't take a call in immediately, but in the second half of the show, feel free to call in at that time, and I'll open the lines up at a later point. The number you would call is 877-876-5227. I invite you also to visit my website at www.zeropoint.ca, and I put a considerable amount of my writing up on my website. Okay, so I think that's most of the kind of business and the announcements today, and I haven't really even thought about where to go today. Other than the first hour, I wanted to have my guest on, James Moffat, and the second hour, I thought today I would focus on the Madame Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine, published in 1888. And explain some of the secret doctrine and its relationship to ideas in modern science. So that'll be in the second half of the show. Thus far, I'd like to begin also by doing a brief review of some of what we've covered sequentially in this radio series. The first show was explored the enigmas of human consciousness. In a way, this is like the most fundamentally important area to be exploring and has most significance to us personally in our lives, because the issues of consciousness have to do with what are we as beings, human beings, and what possibilities are there for the experiences of consciousness. We're interested both in experiences of awakened consciousness within life, and have been discussing the process of self-realization. The idea here is that humankind ordinarily are in a semi-sleepwalking state. We're automized and conditioned by learning influences and our past histories. And so we go through life largely in a semi-sleepwalking state. And the idea of mystical and esoteric teachings concerns the idea of awakening and realizing the self, the true self. In life, ordinarily, people know their personality or egoic nature or self, but not their true self. Their mystics state, know thyself, and thou wilt know the universe and the gods. This suggests that some, it's not knowing your personality and what things you like and dislike and so on. That's not what's going to help you know the universe and the gods. So this axiom suggests that there is some hidden nature to self, and the mystery of life is to uncover this hidden mystery about what we really are as human beings. The teachings you're being presented here are expounding a fundamentally alternative view of the nature of what a human being is. Sometimes I hear people say, have you ever seen extraterrestrial, or do you believe in extraterrestrials? Well, it's interesting because if we understand the teaching I'm expounding here, we understand that we ourselves are not terrestrials. In a way, we make the assumption that we think we're simply terrestrials and me being produced by the earth and material processes on earth. In the views I'm trying to explicate or explain, there is an interior dimensionality to existence, and in a way, we ourselves come down out of higher dimensions or higher planes or from higher places, and we're embodied into the physical body. But the true nature of self transcends that of the body, so that life persists beyond death, and we can experience in other realms of existence beyond death's door. Now, the first show, I began to explore the issues of human consciousness, the idea that how we're ordinarily not properly conscious. So we make an effort as we go through our days to self-remember, which means to wake up to the being present in the moment and cultivate being more conscious and awake in the moment. We try to remember to do that as we live our lives. Because if we're asleep, then what we have to do is make an effort to wake up and be more fully present. So self-remembering is the process of doing this in your life at different times during your day or under different circumstances. So we use self-remembering as a way of studying consciousness. Now, part of the process of understanding consciousness is beginning to differentiate between, in a way, your artificial self or your personality, which in a way is conditioned or taken over from outside of you, from your life influences. So in a way it is taken in as yourself, but it's been conditioned or shaped by the external reality. And as we grow up, consciousness becomes more and more structured around this acquired personality nature. One yogi defines yoga as the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So this suggests that this consciousness system centered on the mind, we aim in a way to dissolve that so that we awaken to the experience within the heart and become established within the heart. I would say it's in human beings' true I, like if we use the letter I as a singular I, is established within the higher dimensional space of the heart, and that there is actually a physics and metaphysics to what the heart actually is. It's not simply a material organ, but instead there's a psychical heart, there's a spiritual heart, there's a divine heart. There are levels within the substrates of being underlying the human heart. So in the explanations of consciousness, I've been comparing Western views, which I call the head doctrine, the belief that the brain within the head produces human consciousness, and I've been comparing that to the heart doctrine, the view that consciousness and self originate from within the heart. It is through the heart that one might know God or know the universe. In one Upanishad, it is said, the earth, the moon, the stars, the sun, all things that are in the outer world are within the lotus of the heart, the cave of Brahman. So, and in my writing, in my book entitled The Heart Doctrine, I explore this theme of the nature of the heart, and I look at Sufism and Muhammad and Christianity and the Vedas and Tibetan Buddhism and Blavatsky and other sources that are all telling us that the secret self, the self to be realized, is established within the heart center. So I'm comparing the head doctrine to the heart doctrine. And in a way, I've defined the process of self-realization as a dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So it suggests a shifting of consciousness or of being self-awareness, that we can actually learn to live and experience more and more fully within the heart space. And through these programs, I try to explain some of what this entails. So the first study aspect of our study has been on consciousness and ideas related to the heart. The second very unusual proposition or teaching, which I elaborate, is the concept that we have zero-point origins. And by that, I often compare the situation to the creation of the universe and the emergence of our huge universe from a singularity point at the first instance of time. In modern science, it's believed that the universe began its unfoldment from a point source. And this concept that a universe grows from a point source, I explained, is also in the secret doctrine of Madame Blavatsky, and it's in Kabbalistic teachings. So I'm arguing that just as a universe, or cosmos has a zero-point origin, so also a human being has a zero-point origin. It is as if we go into the substrates of being, down into the quantum vacuum, we come to a level where, in a sense, there's an infinity of information and potency and energy, all latent within space. And a finite human being emerges out of this infinite root principles of creation. So the infinite unfolds into the finite from a point source. So it's as though one point of that infinite potencies, that becomes the spark of holiness or divine spark within the human being, the ultimate consciousness and life principle. So I'm suggesting, just as the universe emerges from a point of primordial light, so similarly a human being has a point of primordial light established within the higher dimensional physics of the heart. In the Vedas, it's called the Jiva Atma. And the Jiva Atma is described as infinitesimal, and it's compared with the Paramatma, which is the supersoul, the infinite supersoul, which is infinite. So the Jiva Atma is said to be of the same substance as the Paramatma. So it's like a point of light, or a spark of light, or a spark of fire of the infinite supersoul. So each human being has such an element within the higher dimensional physics of the heart. So we ourselves have a zero point center. That is the most important concept here. And in a way, we can cultivate awareness of this zero point center in our life. So this has been that was the focus of the second main radio show that I presented, explored the concept of zero points, both in terms of the origin of the universe and introducing the idea that a human being similarly might have such a zero point source. And this might be identified with what our I is.
We have your caller. Stay with me. I'm going to put him on the air with you.
Okay. Hello? Okay, this is Christopher back. I'm sorry for a brief delay there. We've had my guest has called in, and I'll continue on for a few minutes, and then I think he's listening there in the background, and I'll invite him in a few minutes. I was just trying to review some of what's gone on in previous shows and emphasize the first was on consciousness studies, the second on zero-point studies, and the last show, I explored the concept of the fundamental cosmic laws, that there are fundamental principles of mystical creation, which we find explicated in all different religious and spiritual traditions. And I explained the formula, 1 divided by 1, 3, 7. And the concept that when creation occurs, the one, the unified life source, manifests a threefold nature, and that creates seven planes of being. And this one divided by three to yield seven. And I'm saying that that is actually a model of the structure of reality. And this concept of 1, 3, 7, we can apply that in the study of physics and the study of ancient metaphysics. So last week I focused on initial explications of these principles, the law of three and the law of seven, in terms of understanding creation dynamics. Most important example of this, perhaps, is the concept that a human being has a one, the singular I within the lotus of the heart, your jiva atma or monad. That, in a way, is your unified element. And that monad has a triune nature, and the energies from the monadic essence are then distributed through three channels through a system of seven chakras. So I would argue that there is a whole underlying physics and metaphysics of consciousness and light that underlies our awareness within the material body. Okay, so I began last week to introduce these principles of mystical creation. Okay, so that's to give some review of the history of the first shows here. And now I'd like to say some things and introduce our next guest. James Moffat. James lives in Toronto, and he and I have been lifelong friends, or at least going back to grade 11 in high school, and we went to shared university together, and the late 1970s, I became interested in the Gurdjieff Uspensky fourth way teaching, and I was at that time I was enrolled as a psychology graduate student at the University of Waterloo. And Jim was at Carleton University in Ottawa, also studying psychology and sociology and social sciences and such. And we became enamored of the Gurdjieff Uspensky teaching and shared very deeply working within that system we still work within that system largely today, over 20 years later. But it had profound effects on us individually and in our shared understanding, especially through a early period of 3 to 4 years where we just felt we had achieved so many insights and such a different understanding of the questions of psychology. So Jim and I, we shared, as I say, through over the last 20, 25 years of our studies. And through the time I've worked at my writings, I would say my major book is called The Heart Doctrine, and no one has contributed as much to the editing and refinement of The Heart Doctrine through the years as has Jim. Jim's widely, widely read in philosophy and science and psychology and religion, and very knowledgeable and widely studied. And he's always been a very good critic and commentator on my writings. And I think Jim, more so than anybody else, really appreciates where my writing sits vis-a-vis contemporary thinking or contemporary psychology and science. I think he appreciates more fully than almost anyone other how what a fundamentally different orientation this is that I've elaborated in my work. So I'm going to introduce Jim in a few minutes, but I'm going to, in the Heart Doctrine, I have this one quotation from Jim's writing. Jim's also a writer. Maybe later we'll talk about his writing and his main book. But I have a long quotation in the first chapter of my book. And it's Jim. Jim writes sometimes. He's kind of a combination of a Jonathan Cott and a Tom Robbins, and he's kind of a very, very clever and can capture the essence of something. Anyway, so in this is a quotation from his book, and he's writing about consciousness, and I love this quote. That's why it's quoted in the very first chapter of my writing. Consciousness. What do I mean when I use that term? What is consciousness? Well, that is the big question. As far as questions go, it's pretty much in a class of its own. It is the World Series, the Stanley Cup, the Super Bowl, the Greater Intergalactic Open, and the Heavyweight Championship of the World of big questions, all rolled into one. People win Nobel Prizes, receive huge research grants, become knights of the realm, gain international acclaim and celebrity as scholars in thinking, and much, much more, just for beating around consciousness's bushes or hanging out under its porch light looking for its keys. Mathematicians forge its signature. Physicists trace its shadow. Chemists scour its soup pot. Biologists listen to its heartbeat, draw its bloodlines, and chart its pulse. In the most remote ranges of the Himalayas, there are said to be monks who draw closer to consciousness's door simply by chanting its postal code. Ah, consciousness. The cosmic key that unlocks the door to eternal mysteries. The straw that stirs the universal fluids. The meaning of meaning. The mirror with which God does his tricks. But what, pray tell, is it? You can know it more or less. You can lose it without missing it for the longest time. You can focus it, reflect on it, summons it, elevate it, expand and divide it. You can refine it, define it. You can whine and rhyme and divine it. You can even make space and time for it. But the one thing you can never do is to know consciousness when you do not have it. Pretty tricky business trying to think of what consciousness may or may not be. Questions about the nature of consciousness have stymied some major league thinkers, given others to the intersection of angst and despair, and simply worn out the rest. That's the end of the quotation. And that's from James Moffat, Jim's musings on the mysteries and enigmas of consciousness. Okay, so with that, I'd like to... Jim, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay.
I'm tired.
Sorry, a little mix-up. I thought my show was going... by our time, 5 to 7, and it ended up it was 4 to 6. So just when I sat down to call you and talk to you about the show, I was called up and I had 30 seconds or something.
I realized that we sort of have been displaced in time, but it's okay. I'm in my terrestrial being, so I'm able to accommodate this.
Good.
I just was in the process of moving. My next-door neighbor was helping me carry some bookshelves, and we began to talk about various things, and he said, well... when it's all said and done, he said, what I really want to know is, what is the nature of consciousness?
Oh, really?
Yes.
He said that today?
Yes, about 2 hours ago. And I said, I happen to have an answer for that. I'm not sure it's correct, but I have an answer. It is the major league question. And when you were discussing our beginnings, it's actually 30 years ago, 1976, I think, when we both began to study the fourth way. And I realized at the time, I think that the initial shock of Gurdjieff's work reading this esoteric material was to make me realize that even though we were both graduate students in psychology, psychologists don't really deal with the major issue of psychology, what is the nature of consciousness. And I can still remember the shock waves that sort of went through me when I realized that your initial drafts of your PhD dissertation, which elaborated on Gurdjieff's ideas of consciousness, when you described the process of self-remembering and self-observation, and you said that Gurdjieff claimed that our normal waking consciousness should be understood as a waking sleep, and I thought, well, what does that mean? And is it not really sleep, but a state of associative existence in which everything happens, and that in that state you do not remember yourself, like you are not present in the moment. It thinks, it behaves, it feels, it has emotions, but you, in the sense of I, do not exist. And I remember reading that and thinking, well, this is a very peculiar idea. And so I started to try to remember myself and to try to just hold the experience of being here now and doing whatever I was doing. And of course I realized very quickly that I couldn't, because I kept falling asleep all the time. And each time that you would come to Ottawa with your manuscript, it would be a little bit more in it, I would reread the pages, and when I got to the section on self-remembering, I would try to remember myself, and inevitably I'd be reading along, and all of a sudden I'd realize I'd fallen asleep, that I wasn't conscious, and that the one thing you can't do is you can't know consciousness when you don't have it. So when you fall asleep, you aren't aware that you're asleep, and it all kind of comes full circle with the quote that you just mentioned, that initial experiment, I think, was probably, in some respects, just the attempt to remember yourself is the ultimate, I would say, psychological experiment. It's what convinced me that mystical and esoteric teachings had real validity and that there was something very profound and deep in these teachings.
Yeah, it was amazing. I remember those times. Like, I remember we realized what absolutely fundamental mistakes had been in Western psychology. For instance, like, firstly, the fourth way psychology begins with self-study. Okay. Whereas in Western psychology, when you study it in academia, you never conceive self-study. No one studies yourself in that way. They have no system of self-studying.
It's not scientific.
And the second thing was, in terms of the study of consciousness, everyone's approach to the study of consciousness was either neuropsychological, trying to look for neural correlates of consciousness, or it was analytical, of analyzing other people or experimental situations. But no one considered that you had to study consciousness within yourself, which is what self-remembering is. You use that method to begin to study consciousness in yourself. And so the very basic idea, remember I wrote up Uspensky's 8 definitions of psychology based on the Gurdjieff teaching, and it began with psychology involves self-study, and secondly it involves the study of consciousness, and then you can only study that consciousness in yourself, and psychology must involve a process of self-remembering. Because to understand consciousness, we have to make efforts to wake up, to become more conscious.
Yeah, precisely. And as you say, as psychology students, the idea that you would study yourself is just, that's anathema to good scientific training. You just don't do that. But as Gurdjieff points out, the idea that you can study consciousness willy-nilly without some sort of system in yourself is completely useless. Like, you need a system, and that's what the fourth way provided.
Yeah.
There's a method of studying oneself systematically, just in doing that and by trying to observe and by trying to remember oneself, it completely transformed the basic assumptions about what consciousness is. Like, in Western science and psychology, there are really only two states that are recognized. There's sleep, and then there's a waking state. And nobody really gives any serious consideration to the idea that there are further differentiations possible in the waking state. And on a certain level, that works because most of the time people in the waking state are in a state of waking sleep. But the brilliant thing that you learn through self-study is that if you attempt to observe yourself and you attempt to remember yourself and you attempt to be present by remembering yourself, it introduces all that process introduces all kinds of changes in which you realize that you are asleep. That's the first thing you realize, but you also realize that it's possible to wake up. And even though that's a very distant aim, you realize that there are profound possibilities in that process of waking up.
Yeah, it introduces that whole new element in life. I remember someone saying, using the analogy of the horizontal scale and the vertical scale, and it's like everybody lives on a horizontal flat land, two-plane surface. And if you have this concept of self-remembering, it's like you, at some moment during life on flat land, you wake up, you kind of wake up into this vertical plane, in a sense.
Right.
Like there's movement in this other space, and then that kind of changes or transforms what your life is, how you experience your life.
Yeah, it introduces a new dimensionality of consciousness, and it's kind of like if you were creatures living on a movie screen, bugs on a movie screen, and all of a sudden you were able to escape the surface of the movie screen, and you went out and you realized, oh, there's a light source, and you know that is there are things being projected onto that screen. It would provide a whole different idea of what the nature of reality in the world was. And then if you realize, well, not only are there different lights, but these lights have meaning, and you know there are further differentiations you can make about the nature of the light, and then you can trace it back to the actual making of a film. Each step would add a new dimension to your understanding of what was going on the movie screen. So instead of living in the flat land, you'd realize that there are many more dimensions, higher dimensions, and light sources that account for things.
Yeah. Yeah, the analogy with the screen is an interesting analogy. The whole allegory is similar to Plato's cave, where the prisoners in the cave are chained and the light is behind them, and it casts their shadows on the back wall of the cave, and people take the shadows to be what is real. And Plato says, and imagine if you tried to dissuade that person that was reality and get him to turn around and look into the light. And Plato says how he couldn't do it, like it would take him time to learn to grow accustomed to the light of the higher worlds or to true existence. And so Plato, he says, only finally at the end does the individual turn around and see the sun in its own proper place. So Plato had that idea of turning around and kind of realizing the light behind it all that informs and sustains all of what we think our life is.
And that phrase, I think, is used in a variety of esoteric sources about turning around in yourself as a means of realizing self-transformation and self-realization, that you have to turn around in yourself and realize, see the light and realize that what you take to be reality is actually a projection, or basically a shadow play, a projection of the light source behind you. It's interesting, too, that, when you talk about... I was going to continue on that, but I'll leave that for a second. The idea of light sources, I'll just leave that.
Yeah, we can return to maybe discussions of consciousness and light. But just saying, you were sharing a little bit about, I guess, the thrill of our early discoveries of the Gurdjieff Uspensky teaching. I think it's valuable for us to stay with that and just share some of the other things that...
Yeah, actually,
were such gems to us at that time.
I realized just what I was going to continue by saying, which when you said that in Plato's commentary that you can't just turn around and see it all in one moment. And I realized that I was reflecting on it. It's a rather daunting task to try to deal with your work and try to explain it very quickly, or even to sum it up in a very kind of pithy description. But I realized that the things happen in this uncovering of esoteric and mystical teachings, they happen over a long time. I mean, I think the general misconception that a lot of people have is that, you know, mysticism consists of a moment of great cosmic insight in which you realize some sort of deep spiritual truth about yourself and the nature of the universe. And those moments do happen. But in the more esoteric approach to mysticism, in which there's, you know, an ongoing concerted application of a system and a method, truths tend to reveal themselves in very gradual and very subtle ways, and you can't really, you might get glimpses of things, you might have flashes of insight into the nature of things, but really it's a very long, drawn-out process. And I was thinking about your journey, and I think one of the things that really quite fascinates me about the unfolding of your work is that it's taken you 30 years of full-time work to come to these realizations about that you've articulated in the Heart Doctrine and in your other books.
Yeah.
And so when I hear whenever I hear a disparaging comment from, usually from a scientist, or I read from a scientist some sort of disparaging comment about mysticism as being, I think Stephen Hawking says it's a cop-out for people
yeah.
who can't do science, I think, well, it's completely ludicrous to make that suggestion. I mean, you've only spent 30 years doing this. I've only spent 30 years doing this. And as much as you might even realize that you actually may know something, or you have a suspicion that you know something, you realize that there's so much more to know. The mysteries are incalculable, and I mean that's part of the mystery, in a sense, is that these profound truths exist and these profound teachings exist, and they just can't be apprehended all at once. It's like it's a lifelong, maybe several lifelong studies.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you begin, it's a long process of kind of self-study and discipline of involved in it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, originally, as you say, I think the first, well, we were both psychology students too, which I think gave us a certain orientation towards, especially towards the fourth way, because especially as it's articulated by Uspensky in books such as In Search of the Miraculous, it's written in a language which is, amenable to the modern interpretation in terms of science and psychology, and that captured our interest to a certain extent on that level. But it's just that the perspective was so radically different from anything that we as Western scientists had been trained in, that it just completely illuminated the whole field of psychology for us. I think it just really blew our minds that there were these profound ideas that could so radically recast everything that we thought we knew and lead to such new understandings. And at the same
yeah.
time, I guess the great mystery as we went along and we started to try to communicate these things to other people was that there was this widespread lack of interest and just general ignorance about these ideas. I mean, it's not like this is something that we came up with on our own. These ideas have been around for thousands of years, and there's this entire esoteric mystical tradition with all these profound ideas, and yet most people completely are uninterested, or if they, you know, read about them, they say, well, you know, it's interesting, but they don't see the relevance of them. And I think that's part of the
That's been interesting, hasn't it? I mean, I remember at one point we thought that so many people would be interested in the insights we had and what we were coming to, and it was like everybody was so fixed on their own course and so fixed in their own language that it just sounds a death note for most people.
Yeah, precisely, and I guess, you know, it still to this day it perplexes me that someone could read the description of what self-remembering entails and self-observation, and that they could read that. And I don't know if it's that people don't try to do it, or don't try to practice these things, or if they do, that they don't see how they're asleep. But it really amazes me that. And it just sort of goes in one ear and out the other. But then on the other hand, I realized that at an earlier point in my life, I had read some material on Gurdjieff and Uspensky and something on the fourth way. And I'd even been interested in it, but I didn't really grasp it. I didn't grasp the significance of it. So I suppose there's a certain, you know, there's a certain preparedness for it, and it never ceases to amaze me that people who I wouldn't think would be interested in these ideas, who wouldn't get them, completely get them, whereas other people who I think would be interested in them don't see anything of value in them. It's quite an extraordinary
see that. I think often it's more intellectual types in a way who don't have a feeling for it, whereas other people who maybe live in touch with the elements more or more naturally, they intuitively respond more.
And it's just, getting back to just the sheer excitement of, once I came to the idea that I couldn't remember myself, and that I realized I very firmly believe that, you know, that the Gurdjieff was right, not because Gurdjieff said this or because Uspensky or anybody said this, but that our waking consciousness consists mostly of a waking sleep, and you came up with the term that typically we're embedded, which I really like, or absorbed in our thinking processes, in our emotional processes, in our physiological and physical processes, and that there's no consciousness left over to witness this, that there's no sense of, oh, I am here, which is apart from those processes. Like, in a sense, we are our physical processes, we are our emotional processes, we are our intellectual processes. But when I started thinking of this idea that consciousness consists of not just the contents of awareness, which is basically what Western psychology emphasizes, is that consciousness is the contents of awareness, and primarily in Western psychology it's thought and thinking which people tend to equate consciousness with. But it's the idea that there exists a second part, which is this pure experience of awareness, just witnessing oneself doing and feeling and thinking, which normally doesn't exist but can exist if you can remember to try to evoke it, which I think really changed my whole understanding of consciousness, and I think which really leads to a completely different conceptualization of pretty much everything. You know, it's like sort of a gateway. It's almost like, in your terms, it's almost like a zero point which leads to a new dimensionality.
Yeah, it opens up into a whole other world through, I think, like, some of the, just to give a sense of some of the profound concepts from the Gurdjieff teaching that were so illuminating compared with what we were studying in Western psychology. And you've mentioned one of them that Gurdjieff distinguishes, he says, consciousness must be distinguished from the recognized psychological functions of thinking, feeling, and sensation. So thinking and feeling and sensations, those form on the object side of consciousness. They're things we can be conscious of, but they do not in themselves constitute consciousness. But no, this consciousness is something distinctively different, and it functions to illuminate it so we can be aware of what's on our mind or of our emotions or our sensations. So consciousness is something other than psychological functions. And what we saw in Western psychology was the confusion of psychological functions and consciousness. And particularly in the West, we recognized how all the scientists studying consciousness primarily confused it with cognitive and mental processes. Whereas in the mystical tradition, all these cognitive mental processes are often regarded as an obstacle to the awakening of consciousness, because people are so centered in their minds and the turning of the mind and all the associative thought that goes on all the time, and they take that to be their essential self, and that is an obstacle to experiencing that deeper being self-awareness, that kind of pure, undifferentiated consciousness. So that, I was just saying, that was one of the ideas, that differentiation of consciousness versus the psychological functions.
Yeah,
which was so illuminating in terms
yeah,
of...
Yeah, it's a very useful distinction, and it really turns things on their head, because generally it's part of the assumptive framework which most of psychologists subscribe to, and almost every discussion of consciousness tends to focus on the psychological functions. And as you say, I think the really critical thing is that in the Eastern traditions, these functions are seen as obstacles to the development of consciousness. They're not consciousness. They're obstacles to the development of consciousness.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the idea, and this is the idea that really doesn't exist in Western psychology, is that consciousness can be developed, that consciousness
yeah.
can be transformed. There's absolutely no recognition of that, even in the so-called third force or humanistic psychology, which focused on peak experiences and particular types of consciousness experiences. There's no real idea that this is something that can be systematically pursued and developed, that consciousness can be acquired, and that
yeah.
then that it involves a major transformation in the nature of one's being. And when I think because I understood personally, my own feeling is that once I began to understand that it was asleep, I also came to agree with the idea that Gurdjieff says, is that it's not until you understand that you are asleep that you realize what potentially you could be if you were awake.
Yeah.
And that furthermore, that you, even though you're not awake now, that it's possible, and even though it's a long way from where you are now, that it is possible. And even being awake for a few moments at a time is an experience which is unforgettable, and which makes you realize that the incredible potency of the process of self-transformation. And I think once I sort of acquired that framework, it made me realize that everything in Western psychology was grounded in an assumptive framework which was not so much wrong, but limited.
Well, I mean, I would even say wrong.
I'll take
wrong.
That back.
I mean, well,
okay.
In a way, I think we both came to understand that the fundamental ideas about consciousness, we realize they're fundamentally wrong. Like,
yeah.
Firstly, that identifying consciousness with thinking and the minding functions and thinking consciousness was non-substantive. That's
yeah.
a literature word used in the psychology literature. Consciousness is regarded as non-substantive, as not anything in itself, but only an epiphenomena produced by material processes.
Yeah, or a term to designate those processes. Yeah, and I think that's the other key element, is the substantiality of consciousness and what that means in terms of in esoteric teachings. And first of all, in developing that idea, there's the idea that consciousness is akin to light. It's
yeah.
equated with light. And at first, my own understanding of that was, oh, okay, I see. Like Uspensky says at one point, that consciousness is like light, in the sense that there are certain processes that operate in the dark, but if you shine a light on them, they operate more efficiently. And if you shine a brighter light on them, they operate even that much more efficiently. So I thought, yeah, okay, so consciousness is light. It just means that it's a metaphorical description. But then, as you know, we pursue this material, you begin to understand that, well, consciousness, the equation of consciousness and light has much more profound meanings. It's not just metaphorical, that consciousness is actually equated with the idea of a substance, that consciousness is equated with light, both light as we understand it as an electromagnetic phenomena, and light in terms of the subtle dimensions, and that this is a much, much more complex and subtle explanation of the equation of consciousness and light.
Yeah. Yeah, that's never, it's always considered that, oh, that's only metaphoric.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not realize, no, this needs to be looked at in a scientific way. Like, consciousness is light. Science deals with the nature of light. So we want to explore, you know, what is the physics and metaphysics of light. And
yeah.
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 It's funny, I was just thinking, just staying a bit more with the Gurdjieff Uspensky teaching, it struck me that one of the other most important things I think we both grasped immediately was how Western psychology always tended to be dualistic and see things in a dual manner. And even modern psychology itself is defined as the science of behavior and the mind, as though you only have a mind and the head and the body. Whereas Gurdjieff explains, we have three primary aspects. We function mentally, emotionally, and physically. So human beings have a triune nature instead of a dual mind-body. And something that simple is like so profoundly important, right? In terms of looking at the duality of modern psychology. And there is no modern psychology of the heart, in a way, of the heart or soul.
No.
It's like we have the head and the hands, but we don't have the heart. Whereas in mystical teachings, we have a head, heart, and hands. We have that threefold nature. And you could just see how confused Western psychology theorizing is because of that dualistic framework.
Yeah, well, when I was introduced to the fourth way and I began reading it, I mean, you can make the you can draw a distinction in the teaching between the psychology and the cosmology. And the psychology, I grasped fairly quickly, and it made a lot of sense to me. And there are all sorts of cosmological ideas that I couldn't, I didn't know if these things were true, and I didn't really understand them. But I thought, well, I'll suspend my judgment because the psychology makes so much sense to me. And one of the fundamental aspects of the cosmological aspects of Gurdjieff and Uspensky is the law of three and the law of seven. And the law of three, I began to really understand the law of three psychologically when you pointed out, how common that how common and pervasive dualistic thinking is in modern psychology. And it's actually in everything. And Gurdjieff describes dualistic thinking as, sometimes he calls it formatory thinking, and it's thinking of least resistance. It's mechanical thinking. It's thinking in which there's this and there's that. There's one thing and it's opposite. And all the time in Western conceptualizations and conscious in psychology, there are all kinds of dualistic formulations. So somebody comes up with an idea of intuition, and then there's intuition and rationality, and then there's personality I was going to say personality essence, but that's a Gurdjieff conceptualization. But there are all sorts of dualities that run throughout Western psychology, and I realized that this is a very basic example of how seeing things in terms of threes was more comprehensive and less limiting than seeing them in terms of twos.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
yeah, it's so profound, but it really helps to understand the law of three understand how we're normally dualistic, and then you begin to see how sensible it is.
Yeah.
Because you begin to realize third, fourth in things.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always some sort of a neutralizing or mediating force, and that makes I think actually at some point Gurdjieff says that the beginning of acquiring consciousness is to recognize the third force in things, and to pass from dualistic and formatory understanding into an understanding of the Holy Trinity and the law of three and everything. And that goes back, of course, to what you were speaking earlier of, that God is first one, then three, then seven, which is, which is, on some level it sounds so simplistic, but if you really understand everything associated with it, you realize what an incredibly potent axiom that is, that it means so much. I mean, and that's one thing I think that over time, many years as you study mystical and esoteric teachings, you realize something as simple as there's an ancient Hermetic aphorism, as above, so below. I mean, four words, but it contains worlds, if you really understand what that means.
Yeah.
And that's one of the, I think, the real beauties of pursuing these teachings, is that it's always something that further elaborates on what seem at the beginning to be fairly fundamental and basic ideas. You know, not terribly complex, but they contain so much.
Yeah. Yeah, I consider I've studied now the laws of 3 and 7 for 30 years.
Yeah.
And I we were both in a similar position, I think, when we were introduced to that concept. We both suspended judgment about it, like the law of 3 and the law of 7. How could you have a number in a law? Like, it just didn't make sense. But then over time, you really begin to grasp how significant that is.
And the other side of it, too, is that you realize when sometimes when people are criticizing so-called mystical ideas, they'll present them in the most simplistic terms, and their own very limited understanding of them will lead them to debunk them or to expose them as being ridiculous. But really, it's an act of self-deception because, you know, the so-called debunker is really just attesting to his own ignorance of what's actually entailed. You know, that they'll latch onto some very simplistic representation of a so-called mystical idea, and then supposedly reveal how simplistic it is. Whereas, you know, it's the other way around. It's the debunker who's really hasn't really grasped how incredibly complex these ideas are.
Yeah,
and that's. I guess, going back to the original introduction to esotericism for me, I think that was a big part of it. At some point, Yaspensky says something to the effect that in order to find something of interest in the fourth way, you have to be dissatisfied with the usual explanations in life. And I think that applied to both of us, is that although we were both psychology students and we're interested in a variety of topics in psychology, something was missing, and we weren't satisfied with the usual explanations. And so, when we came across this material, we were willing to suspend our judgment. And I think that's what you have to do if you're really going to give these teachings a fair hearing. You have to suspend your judgment because it's a completely different understanding of the nature of things.
Yeah, and you're not going to grasp it all at once. It takes effort, struggle to gain an understanding, an experience of what's being discussed.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I was thinking of how I would try to comment on the heart doctrine, and I was thinking that, you know, one of the things that you have to kind of caution people is that you're not going to be able to grasp all this at once. I mean, parts of it you'll probably find very interesting, and parts of it will puzzle you. But that's the nature of the beast, is that you can't grasp this all at once because these are very radically different ideas from what you're used to and from the conventional explanations of things, and they require a certain amount of deliberation and a certain amount of consideration, and you have to try to work with these ideas. They're not just something that can land on you and suddenly illuminate you. You're not going to understand them in those senses. You have to kind of work through things and try to see things from a different perspective.
Yeah, it was interesting when you edited the Heart Doctrine before my most recent version of this. I remember some of your comments. It was like you'd read the material 3-4 times, but as your understanding grows, you grasp ever more deeply, like just how profound and how alternative this is.
Yeah.
Even myself, sometimes I read my writing and holy smokes, it's like almost like I didn't write it myself.
Well, and I mean, and I think that's for all those listening to us, I mean, we're not sitting around here congratulating ourselves about how clever we are or anything. I mean, this is your interpretation of these ideas and your articulation of them, and it's quite an intellectual achievement and a great piece of scholarship in my mind. That's my opinion. But these ideas come from true giants in the history of humanity's quest to know itself. These are ancient teachings that people have given their lives to developing, and I guess that the extraordinary thing is that they're so poorly appreciated, or you know, that they just don't seem to fall on that many people, and if people really looked at them closely and tried to understand them, then I think for those who are open-minded enough, I think they'd find them extraordinarily rich, and the content of them is really inspiring in terms of realizing the possibilities of what we are as human beings, what the possibilities inherent in human being actually consist of.
Yeah. Okay, so it's coming back here. So, yeah, I mean, I would say about the heart doctrine, I mean, that's, it reminds me of when I first read Uspensky in The Fourth Way, and he said, if this book were just my ideas, well, I mean, maybe they'd be useful, maybe not, but really they're not. What I'm doing, Uspensky said, is articulating, you know, this model of creation that's presented to me.
Yeah.
And that's what I've done. Like, in the heart doctrine, it's not Dr. Christopher Holmes' theory about consciousness. What it is I've gleaned essential ideas from a wide range of mystical sources and show the commonality of this element, and then saying, let's look at this seriously, scientifically, philosophically, psychologically. These are serious ideas. It's not just poetry of the heart and soul, but these people are actually telling us things about the heart and higher dimensions and so on that can be looked at within the scientific framework, as well as examined within personal experience. So the heart doctrine isn't, I've played that role. That's what it is. And really, I'm dealing with, as you say, like these giants, you know, through the history of humankind who have provided, you know, this alternative model of the nature of self. And I've kind of brought those together and shown how to compare that to modern scientific viewpoints. So
yeah,
that's kind of been my role a bit.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're, in a sense, you're a transducer of certain higher thought and consciousness. But these ideas exist, and I guess what I would say, I think that when I read it, I mean, as you said, I've studied esoteric and mystical ideas for 30 years. When I read it, I guess one of the things that really knocks me out is that I'm incredibly impressed by is the range of scholarship that, in terms of esotericism, that your work entails. But then, what I think is really unique about your work is that you use it to investigate it comparatively with modern science, and you use it in terms of revealing some of the limits of modern science, and you formulate it in terms of a model that can be investigated by somebody who is a scientist, who subscribes to a scientific viewpoint. These aren't things that one has to accept on in terms of faith or you know, blindly believe in. Precisely the opposite, but they're put forward as propositions to be investigated, and I think that's one of the really the great merits of your work, is that it really invites people to, you're not trying to convince anybody of anything, and it's not your ideas, but you're trying to draw attention to something that's incredibly profound and which is really not given its due, and also, as I say, you articulate in terms of modern science. I mean, there may be, I don't know, comparative religious scholars or students of mysticism who present these ideas in other contexts, but I don't think there are too many people who compare them with ideas in modern psychology and modern physics, and I think that's a real distinguishing feature of your work and why it's really worth.
I mean, I guess that's the whole concept of Zero Point as an institute for mystical and spiritual science, and.
Yeah.
You know, it goes back to what we were discussing earlier about how in Western literature so much we think dualistically, so we see, oh, religion versus science, like they're opposites, or rational versus irrational. Like that's how all the debunkers present it, as though it's irrational pseudoscience compared with real science, that, you know, Carl Sagan's real science and Stephen Hawking. and what they think is real science. And in a way, it's a false dichotomy, and really the ultimately, I'm arguing that there is a scientific basis to mystical teachings. Our science is just not advanced enough yet to grasp it. So we need to bring the mystical perspective and synthesize it with science.
I'm sorry, I was going to say, that kind of talk will get you incarcerated, you know. But, well, you know, on the heart doctrine, as I say, on one level, I think the book is an amazing piece of scholarship in terms of elucidating these ideas, in terms of articulating them and bringing them together. But, you know, it really, that in itself is an achievement, your examination of consciousness and through the heart doctrine and contrasting it with the head doctrine. Because at the very least, I think anybody who is interested in the study of consciousness should read this book, because it reveals the assumptive framework which underlies Western science and psychology in terms of its consideration of consciousness. There's no question that your book at least challenges the orthodoxy of Western thought on nature of consciousness. And that would in itself be a great achievement. But what really impresses me, and which I think makes your book completely unique, is the concept of the zero point. Because the zero point, this is a concept which you draw the parallel. Well, which you say, you know, is implicated in the creation of everything from worlds to human beings, and it's the common dynamic which underlies the manifestation of everything in the material world from the subtle dimensions. And when you draw the comparison between, you know, the creation of the universe and the creation of an intelligent human being in terms of zero point dynamics, then you're on to something that I think is completely unique. I don't know of anybody else who makes that claim.
Yeah, no, it's funny. In the contemporary literature, I don't know of anyone else arguing that human beings have zero-point centers. Even among, Greg Braden, I guess, discusses awakening to zero-point, but in a very, very different context. I think he's dealing more with cycles of history and such. But no one deals with I've never seen anyone else present that as a serious scientific idea, that we have zero point or singularity type origins. Yes, it's really quite shocking, even though it, like the heart doctrine, is an idea. Once you hear it, you begin to see it in different sources, like, you know, the idea of the divine spark in Sufism, or Gnostic Christian teachings is a divine spark, or the sparks of holiness of the Kabbalists.
Yeah.
So once you have the concept of zero point, you begin to realize, oh yeah, this element is there in diverse teachings. And again, I guess I've played the same role in trying to bring these diverse teachings together in the commonality of that zero point element or teaching.
Yeah. You know, it made me think too that I wanted to say that. I don't know if you've talked about the problem of God's contracting universe at all in your previous program, but after you were the first couple of years of your investigation of the fourth way and kind of coming to this different understanding of the nature of consciousness, you began to write about what you call the problem of God's contracting universe, which came from Carl Sagan's comment in his book, Broke His Brain, when he wrote that it seems that as science advances, there is less and less for God to do. And what he meant by that was that as we gain more understanding of the natural processes involved in various manifestations in creation, there's less and less reason to invoke a God to explain anything. And so basically God is being squeezed out by the advancement of science. And eventually science will explain everything, and therefore there will be no need to postulate a God's existence to explain anything or any other supernatural force. And when he articulates that, one of the things he says, it's very interesting, he says that he's, you know, Sagan is essentially his trumpeting the importance of science as a source of illumination, as overcoming human ignorance and especially superstition and which he generally attributes to religion. And one of the things he says is that there have been thousands of religious teachings throughout the ages, and that surely, because there are so many different teachings, most of them must have been wrong. And even though that idea is specious in the sense that there are very many different scientific ideas, and that doesn't mean that they're all wrong,
yeah.
It means that they focus on different parts. But one of the things I realized in reading the Heart Doctrine was, well, okay, if you accept Sagan's point, then the recurrence of the description of the importance of the heart in generating consciousness and the recurrence of the idea of the zero point, once you start to recognize it, would tend to suggest that if you accept Sagan's premise that, there's something scientific about this in the sense that there's a consistent and recurring recognition of the same principles.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like all the religions differ in the outer forms, like the rituals and dogmas and terminology and so on, but there seem to be certain common elements to the esoteric side of those same religions. Like Sagan's, his comments apply more to the exoteric or popular side of religion, but not to the hidden mystical teachings at the core of each of the religions.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because looking back on it, I mean, I've used the word esotericism a lot during the program, and one of the things that really astounded me when I first started reading about the Fourth Way was that Uspensky's discussion of esotericism, and he said that in a way it's the idea that's least understood by people in human history is the idea of esotericism, and he said, you know, the idea of esotericism runs throughout human history, that there exists a secret knowledge which is superior to ordinary knowledge and which certain highly evolved individuals have apprehended through the perfection of their consciousness and being, and that this knowledge is supposedly contains secrets about oneself and about the nature of the cosmos, and it's knowledge which is acquired not solely through intellectual means, and that it's been passed on from generation to generation through direct tuition, and that there have existed organizations throughout human history which preserve and transmit this knowledge. And until I read that, I had never really grasped anything about the nature of esotericism. The concept meant absolutely nothing to me. And I think that esoteric aspect of a religion is the core, generally. And as you say, those core beliefs tend to have certain common principles. And then there's an exoteric or outer organization which is imposed on the original esoteric teaching. And that changes and becomes manifested in different ways which differ from other religions. And then there are all sorts of acquisitions of rituals and observances which accompany that, and which emphasize the differences in religions. But really, if you accept the idea of esotericism, there is this inner core of basic ideas about the nature of both human beings and the cosmos, and in the possibilities of transforming consciousness and realizing the unity of the cosmos.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. If we think of it like some of the core common elements, I guess all the religions have the common element that ultimately there's a unified being or source of life that thrills throughout everything. That's a fundamental teaching, that there is a God as a omniscience or omnipresence. So everything manifests out of this divine realm, of unified realm, and that we can experience the unity of ourself with the world in different states of consciousness. I mean, mysticism often is defined as that search for unity, that unitive experience. So there's that concept. The heart doctrine is common to esoteric teachings. The zero-point hypothesis is common. And then I would say that formula 1 divided by 3, 7 is a common feature. Like last week I spoke about that, the 1-3-7 in the Gurdjieff teaching, in Blavatsky, in the Vedas, in Kabbalah. And we find it in Sufism, another teaching. So it's, again, it's that kind of metaphysical, those subtle metaphysical principles we can find within the esoteric tradition.
Yeah. And it's,
so, by the way, I haven't mentioned the problem of God's contracting universe, and I thought that we might pick up on that in 2 weeks' time and go through that history and define the terms a bit, and that we might, you know, I might invite you next week that we could have that as the focus of next week's, or in 2 weeks, the show in 2 weeks would be based on the problem of God's contracting universe. We can kind of explore it from Sagan and the philosophy of science and so on.
Yeah, I think that would be very interesting. Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, I guess in reading the heart doctrine and reflecting on the concept of the zero point, and then reading material from both the Sufism and from the Kabbalistic teachings, you know, that this idea of like the divine spark and the singularity exists in these teachings, and Jonathan Cott's conversation with Rabbi Kushner, in which he describes, you know, scientists have described a primordial single point, you know, which everything was contained and then exploded. And then Rabbi Kushner says, well, you know, that idea existed. It's in the Kabbalistic teachings from the, I don't know, the 14th century or whatever. And I mean, it's quite extraordinary when you realize that, you know, these most recent, supposedly highly developed ideas from this incredibly sophisticated physics have been around for hundreds and thousands of years in these esoteric teachings.
Yeah.
How do you explain that?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, it's inexplicable.
A friend of mine says it's all a coincidence, you know. I think he's grasping at straws.
Yeah, it's amazing. And these people have these realizations in mystical states of consciousness. Like the idea of the singularity source of creation, people have experienced that, have experiences of these types of processes. So people who arrived at that, at the direct experience, and then it's, you know, 1,000 years later, science finally arrives at the idea of the point source origination of the cosmos, whereas that goes back in Judaism, you know, over 2,000 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in the Vedas, I gave a lecture in Montreal last week, and a lady brought up, oh, that's the Bindi point. I wasn't familiar with that term, and she was explaining, yeah, in the Vedas, creation begins from the Bindi point. So, you know, it's just another thing that I have to research,
yeah.
You know, another kind of confirmation in the ancient Vedas of this singularity point.
And the Vedas are about 4,000 years old?
Yeah, the Upanishads, I think, are dated 3,000 to 5,000 years. If not, I mean, people from India claim some of them are much older than that. But
yeah, I mean, let's say that when you get into trying to establish timelines for ideas like that, that you're really, in a way it's almost irrelevant. It's just that they're very ancient, and who knows, they may be the recapitulation of even earlier ideas. Nobody really knows. But
Yeah, we can't lose the thread in antiquity, kind of.
Yeah, and we didn't... We didn't really explain earlier that the fourth way, which Gurdjieff brought to the West, he claimed that it was a very, very ancient teaching which had disappeared for thousands of years. And that he rediscovered and he articulated in terms that were more conducive to the modern mind, but which he you know, seriously argues that this teaching is literally been around for thousands of years, and it's hard to believe that something that complex and that profound, could have existed for so many years and then disappeared. And you even wonder about the dynamics of that. Why did that happen? Why did it go underground, or why did it disappear, and why has it reappeared at this time? But it's quite humbling to consider the idea that such extraordinarily complex and lucid ideas, profound ideas, could exist and then sort of disappear from human history for so long. You know, it's very odd.
Yeah, I mean it's so amazing. Generally, I find how much the whole esoteric tradition is ignored in the whole of the modern educational system and modern philosophy and science. It's like there's this complete void there that just people just have no idea of the significance of these areas. Like, I remember back when we thought we were pretty educated young men 30 years ago when we were kind of existentialists we'd studied philosophy and psychology and science, and through the whole of my educational system, I was never exposed to esoteric teachings in any discipline, even in philosophy.
Yeah.
You know, or psychology. No one even mentioned those areas. So it's like the educational system completely lacks any appreciation. So there are our educators have no knowledge of these areas and of their significance.
Yeah, and that's what I was getting at earlier when I said, I had no idea about this. And then what really compounds it, in part, it's a reaction to some of the abuses of mystical teachings that appear, but it's interesting that so many skeptics and scientists regularly disparage and dismiss mysticism, and that's a catch-all term for everything that they regard as insubstantial and irrational and kind of out there crazy ideas. But when they say that, really, most of them have absolutely no idea what they're talking about when they talk about the mystical tradition. I mean, mystical traditions as a label covers an incredibly wide variety of topics and approaches and methods, and part of that is the esoteric tradition. So really, people just dismiss out of hand these incredibly profound and complex teachings and have absolutely no idea what they entail. And,
yeah.
On that level alone, the Heart Doctrine, that's another reason why I'd recommend somebody read the Heart Doctrine. Well, read this with an open mind and, make of it what you will. But I would say that anybody who read it with an open mind couldn't help but be impressed by the consistency of these ideas throughout time and the utterly lucid nature of their articulation. I think that, it's the farthest thing from something that's vague or insubstantial or which lacks intellectual rigor. I mean,
yeah.
It's completely the opposite. These things are these teachings are articulated in incredibly elegant and lucid terms and are utterly rational. You couldn't get anything more rational. They may point to processes and phenomena which exist beyond simple intellectual apprehension, but the explanation of them is entirely rational and lucid.
Yeah. You see that when you study the mystical literature more deeply. I was just thinking an example is the equation of consciousness with light.
Yeah.
And you can read all these different sources, and you find that's what all the so many mystics are saying. They're talking about light gaining, and even the concept of being enlightened.
Yes.
Implies a higher consciousness involves this greater influx of light, this inward illumination.
Yeah.
And you can follow that from ancient Christian and Gnostic texts up to the Dalai Lama, who says that consciousness is conjunction of the mind of clear light and the minute space particles. And that human consciousness is a conjunction of those two elements, the light consciousness and the space particles, empty space particles. He also has human beings, the foundations for human consciousness is like a zero-point source. He calls them empty space particles. Okay, so again, it's these very, but as you're saying, I mean, it's like the depth and significance of these ideas has not been appreciated in modern thought and science, not because of their superficiality, but in a way, really, because of the depth and otherliness of these teachings. It's like trying to persuade people to turn around and see the light. You know, it takes time to get accustomed to the sight of the higher world and what it all means. And like Plato's analogy, the man chained in the cave, it takes time to grow accustomed to this other way of thinking and understanding. But then at a certain point, certain ideas are so illuminating that as you understand it more and more, you begin to see evidences of it, not only in the literature, but in everyday life. Like for me now, I'm often aware of just how when people say I, or they talk from the heart, how they refer to the heart and point to the heart and feel in the heart, how that's all in our language. And you see that every day, I think, this intuitive knowledge people have of the heart. But people don't realize, like, how significant this is. But it's there, and once you begin to understand it, then you begin to, it illuminates things that happen in the day-to-day way and your own, the nature of your own experience.
It's interesting in Jonathan Cott's book on the Sea of Memory, in which he talks about his experience of losing many years of his life through electroconvulsive therapy. He lost his memory of many years of his life, and it's a meditation. The book is a meditation on memory. At one point he speaks about, isn't it interesting that we say that when we really incorporate something, we learn it by heart?
Oh, yeah.
You know, so again, as you say, there are all sorts of these intuitive and common expressions which seem to incorporate that idea that there's an intelligence centered in the heart, which is an essential intelligence. Getting back to the light, Aldous Huxley, I'm not sure exactly when he wrote this essay, but he wrote an essay about the experience of light and what it means to be enlightened. And of course, you know, there are famous examples like St. Paul on the road to Damascus was blinded by the light. You know, and of course, some people now say that he had an epileptic fit, and others say that that he was illuminated by higher consciousness and intelligence. But he talks about, you know, there are several famous examples. Plotinus had that experience also, being enlightened. But then he, in his essay, he describes the experience of several quote unquote ordinary people who had experiences of being enlightened, where literally the entire area around them was illuminated with this incredibly subtle light, and they had experiences of higher realization of their nature themselves and their unity with God. And he describes several examples of this, and it's interesting that in each case, the person, after they has this experience, felt that they had come to an understanding of the essential all-rightness of life, the meaning of it, and that they stopped fearing death. I think that was one of the common elements, that after these experiences of illumination, they didn't fear death anymore, that they realized that when their body died, that was not going to be the end of them, and that there would be some sort of returning of a higher principle in themselves to the source.
Yeah.
Which again, as you know, in terms of just as evidence of, you know, these ideas, it's quite startling that people without any kind of training which would orient them towards thinking this way would have these experiences.
Yeah, without any training, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's why in the history it seems to occur spontaneously to different people
sometimes. Yeah. And
it was like the Canadian psychiatrist Richard Buck, who wrote The Cosmic Consciousness.
Yes.
He was a psychiatrist at the time in London Psychiatric Hospital, and he had this experience of cosmic consciousness and of Brahman and so on. And but he had no preparation for it. It just came upon him, this kind of afternoon of experience and illumination. And he said, according to Buck, he never again in his life could re-experience that state. It just came upon him, and it was overwhelming and so ineffably real to him that it just washed away his prior understanding.
Huh, yeah.
So these things can come in flashes by grace, or and then at other times it's more that people kind of climb that stairway of realization. If you have school influences or esoteric school influences that allow you to progress, I think, in a more stepwise fashion.
Yeah, it's interesting. Different paths towards this same sort of realization. That again, you know, when we were talking earlier about when we initially became interested in esoteric ideas of consciousness, that one of the things that really struck me, and which had always disturbed me as a psychology student, was that anybody who pokes around and does any kind of reading about altered states of consciousness realizes that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of accounts of experiences of illumination and higher realization, and you know,
yeah,
whether what those actually entail or what they mean is subject to debate. But what really always disturbed me about the kind of Western conceptualizations of consciousness is that they were completely ignored, that there was nothing within the framework of the understanding of the mind, which most psychologists articulate and subscribe to, which has anything to say about these. Like, they're kind,
yeah,
of like, you know, the relative that nobody speaks about, you know, who's kept locked away in the attic and you know, never allowed to show his face because it's, you know, that presence is disturbing somehow, and it upsets the understanding of how things are and how they should be. And as I say, like, if you really look at it with an open mind, I mean, there's no doubt that many, 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 many people have had these experiences. And not just experiences, but these profound senses of realization that I think anybody who has an open mind could not dismiss.
Yeah. Okay, so where are we? What do we want to pick up on here? I'm realizing we probably have about a half hour left, so I think we may as well just hold online and continue to share today, and maybe what we'll do next week, we'll take the first half of the show next week to introduce the problem of God's contracting universe, and I'll follow that with what I was going to have today on the second half, which is an introduction to Blavatsky's secret doctrine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so
that'd be very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll plan that for our next show. But I think we may as well just continue along in the vein we're on and see it through for the remainder of this show. Did you by chance, Jim? Did you receive your new copies of the Heart Doctrine, the Microcosm, Macrocosm?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
Yeah. Thank you. And
okay.
Actually, now I'm going to make a present. You just sold a book because I'm going to give the guy who helped me move and wants to know what the nature of consciousness is, I'm going to give that to him as a present for helping me move.
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll send another one off to you.
It was an interesting synchronicity that he should, you know, it sort of
say that to you.
Came out of nowhere, too, because I wasn't sort of talking about these ideas. He was the one that started it, you know, and he said, well, I've read, you know, extensively in Western philosophy, and he said everybody talks around it, but nobody really talks about what is the nature of consciousness, you know, and so that's what I want to know what is consciousness.
Yeah, that's funny, and that just happened today. That's so funny because then you come on the show and I read that quote. I've always loved
yours.
Yeah,
and I had no idea that you were going to read that quote.
No, you didn't. No,
I actually mentioned to this fellow Alex. I said, "Well, it's funny you should say that because I actually asked that question myself in writing, you know, in my own writing, and it is the essential question, and." I guess that's the other thing too, is that looking back on those early days when we began studying the fourth way, it made me realize that when I started reading, there's a conversation between Uspensky and Gurdjieff, and Uspensky said, well, you know, he was very learned, and he said it's generally considered that you know, consciousness is undefinable, and Gurdjieff said, the usual scientific sophistry, complete rubbish, and said, you know, the important thing to understand is that you can know consciousness, and he emphasized those words. You can know consciousness, but you can only know it when it's present, and when it's gone, you won't understand that it's gone until later when you realize that it's disappeared. And it's a very simple but at the same time very complex idea, because it really signifies that what we take to be our normal waking state is not a continuous, undifferentiated single state, but there are moments when we're closer to consciousness, and then there are other moments when we're completely asleep, we're embedded in whatever we're doing. And when I began to kind of try to remember myself and realized, yeah, this is true, that there are moments when you can kind of come closer to waking up. You know, you can have these moments when you are really aware that you're here in this moment experiencing whatever it is you're experiencing. And usually those things happen to us involuntarily in life, if like when we're traveling or we have some sort of dramatic event happen to us and everything's crystal clear. You can, you know, you have your memory of it is so lucid because you are there at that moment. And when I realized that this was possible to acquire this, I realized that Western psychology completely does not understand or recognize this. It just assumes the general assumption, the conventional thinking is that when you're awake, and that's it.
Yeah.
That's consciousness. And consciousness is really, the study of consciousness is really the study of thinking, cognitive processes.
Yeah.
And that's basically it. And even more so, the typical approach now is not even to really understand thinking, but to understand its neural correlates. So what's happening in the brain when we're doing different types of thinking? Well, those are all very useful. You know, I'm not dismissing that as a study, a worthy study. It is a worthy study. It's an important study, but it's not consciousness.
Yeah, there's such pervasive confusion about that basic term consciousness, and it is impossible simply to define it in words. As Gurdjieff says, you have to have experiences of awakened consciousness, and as you have those experiences, then you can know consciousness more in yourself. It doesn't mean you can necessarily put it in words even or articulate what it is, but we have to have that inner approach to this understanding consciousness. You know what you're saying about how in the West we kind of think there's just one, you know, you're kind of conscious through the day and then you're asleep and you're unconscious. And from this article from Scientific American where they had an article on the quest to find consciousness, and I'll quote from the author, Roth. He says, any efforts to understand consciousness must begin by noting that it comprises various states. At one level of the spectrum is the so-called alertness or vigilant states. States of lower consciousness include drowsiness, dozing, deep sleep, and so on down to coma. So it's like the highest level is being vigilant, which is like being awake and alert.
Yeah.
And then from there, it's just down to, you know, drowsiness, dozing, sleep, and down into coma. But there's nothing beyond that, just being vigilant.
Yeah.
You know, that's the modern understanding. They don't appreciate that there could be qualitatively distinct higher levels of consciousness each which might have their own nature and capacities, and that would be revealed in those states.
Yeah, and then again, that goes to it's just generally assumed that you're awake, and that's all there is to it. I mean, what goes hand in hand with that is there's no recognition of the idea of self-transformation or the perfecting of one's consciousness and the realization of a permanent higher state of consciousness. Like, that idea just does not exist in Western psychology.
No.
And what goes with that is, of course, as you study yourself and begin to, what I found, what sort of shocked me was that as you study yourself and as you work on trying to develop consciousness, is that the process of transformation is really a psycho-spiritual transformation, and that there's a spiritual aspect to this that, again, by inclination, I wouldn't say that I was sympathetic especially or inclined towards any kind of religious or spiritual perspective. But as I studied and worked on myself to try to develop consciousness in terms of the fourth way teaching, I began to recognize that the self that I was trying to remember didn't refer to the normal self, my personality, but rather referred to a higher aspect of my being, and which wasn't a personal aspect, but more the divine principle, for lack of a better word, in myself. This is latent or dormant within each of us and needs to be awakened.
We're coming up to the end of the hour.
Okay, so we have just a minute or two to wind up here, Don?
Correct.
Okay, thanks. Okay, well, thanks for coming on today, Jim. It's certainly easier carrying the show with someone on to help out.
Well,
not quite as many gaps there, and it seemed to flow pretty easily today.
Dead air is the enemy of radio. Yeah, I think it would be interesting to explore the whole question of the problem of God's contracting universe and sort of the history of your exploration of that question, because it really leads to your current work. And I mean, I think it really describes that, even though it was something you began 25 years ago, it in a sense, I think it kind of characterizes your work as your attempt to ask the question, is it in fact true that as science advances, there's less and less for God to do? And there's a lot of different angles we can explore that question from.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, thanks very much, Jim.
Yeah.
And
we'll
have you back in 2 weeks. And to listeners, thanks for tuning in again today. And the show will be available through the archives within several weeks, and I invite you back. You can email me, I'll remind you, at christopherholmes@rogers.com, and I do invite people to view my website at zeropoint.ca. Thanks very much. Thanks, Don and Doug, and we'll speak again in 2 weeks, and make an effort to remember yourself as you go about your life. Jim and I have been speaking the importance of remembering ourselves. At one level in ourselves, we are already awake, and in a way we're trying to get back to that level of wakefulness which is already existent within us at a higher level. But we study consciousness by trying to remember ourselves and to be more conscious in our lives. Thanks very much, and keep heart, and we'll speak again in 2 weeks.
Take care, Chris.
Good day.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.